an NITV radio podcast. For the full program, visit sbs.com.au/NITV radio.
Tēnā rā koutou katoa, tēnā koe Yvonne, nā ui whakatau mai a tātou katoa, ngā rangatira katoa, ngā kaikōrero, huri noa kia tātou katoa, tēnā rā koutou. Well, lovely to be here, and as Larissa said, I'm here to talk about the realities on the ground in New Zealand, in the New Zealand context, and I've managed to jam all my points into two key points, which I'm going to rush through as I watch for the time. But really, our experience in New Zealand suggests that the reality on the ground is messy, and the thinking and the relationship changes over time. And the second point really is that friendship is vital. Often in political settings, the recognition of the extent and value of soft power is underestimated. However, good faith negotiations and ongoing relationships require trust and care, soft power values that are central to friendships. So my first point is about the reality on the ground. It's inevitably messy, and the relationship and the thinking changes over time. So in one sense, what the treaty has provided Māori is a position within New Zealand's constitutional arrangements from which to be involved in some central and local government decision making, particularly relating to natural resources. There are seven guaranteed Māori seats in a national parliament of 120. There are treaty clauses in some legislation which stipulate nothing in those acts shall permit the Crown to act in a manner inconsistent with the treaty. But ultimately, in New Zealand's system with an unwritten constitution, parliamentary supremacy remains. So one of the first messy realities about having a treaty is that the treaty relationship is unavoidably connected with holding each side to account and connected with a process for resolving disputes about the behaviours of either party. In our case, it's usually the behaviour of the Crown, which is a cause for concern. The Crown has historically and continues to regularly breach the principles of the treaty. So this requires regular monitoring and costly responses by Māori, usually to the Waitangi Tribunal, which is our permanent statutory commission of inquiry, where Māori can take cases related to breaches of the treaty. But it doesn't actually have the powers to enforce anything from there. So much of the current treaty-based or treaty-related discussions are about ongoing breaches of the treaty and how to rectify the Crown's behaviours. And I'll just provide you two recent-ish examples. One relates to the proposal for a Kermadec ocean sanctuary. So at the UN in 2016, the then Prime Minister John Key announced an ocean sanctuary at the UN and then returned home to try and legislate. This was before talking to any Māori groups who have rights to fishing quota in that particular area and have rights to be involved in any statutory decisions relating to that area from our Fisheries Act 1992, which allegedly, fully and finally, settled commercial rights to fishing. So that's one example. So theoretically, that shouldn't have gone ahead. We've had a change in government, so that particular legislation is stalled. The second example I would give, and there are many, but these are just sort of top of mind, is the annual tender process that we have for petroleum and minerals prospecting and exploration. These routinely offer private companies access to land over which there are numerous treaty settlement related agreements and that really shouldn't make that possible. Another of the messy changes in terms of the reality of the Treaty of Waitangi on the ground is that it was originally signed between chiefs of hapū, so smaller tribes, and the British Crown. We have, however, had two pan-Māori national settlements. One is related to fisheries in 1992 that I just mentioned, and the other relates to aquaculture in 2004. So these are negotiated at a national level and weren't with place-based or land-based smaller tribes. So there are questions here then, because as a result of colonisation, nearly 17% of Māori do not know which hapū or iwi they're from, and therefore have rightly asked who speaks for them and how they'll see the benefits of those national settlements made in their name. So this connects with the challenge of mandate. The votes that iwi have taken regarding whether to accept redress settlements with the Crown have commonly been democratic, one person, one vote, with a system of first past the post, because that's the preference really of the Crown for that particular model. But several urban Māori groups have queried how those who are not registered with their tribal entity are able to be fairly represented there. Approximately one in six Māori live in Australia, so that's another issue of how they can continue to be guaranteed their treaty rights. Or indeed, the other side of it is whether they've forfeited their rights by moving away for several generations, and that's a serious issue. I would also just note that at least one tribe, Tūhoe, have, after their settlement, changed their voting process to a collective consensus approach. So they don't actually have voting any longer, and tribal members must participate within their own traditional communities to have a say and be represented. Another of the messy changes across time has been what's on the table as part of the treaty relationship and redressing breaches of the treaty. And I want to give you a couple of examples here as well. One is relativity clauses, which were provided to the first two tribes that had their settlements, were settling historical claims, but weren't on the table for subsequent iwi. So what that means is those first two iwi have now had annual pro rata top-ups, essentially, since 2013, which have effectively doubled their settlements, approximately 161 and 101 million, respectively, to Waikato Tainui and Ngaitahu, because the original cap, which was supposed to be $1 billion, was breached in 2013. Those relativity clauses were offered for the first two iwi, but not to subsequent iwi, so there are serious issues there. Another example of change across time relates to water bodies. The space occupied by water and the space occupied by air, this is actually a thing, was not on the table when my own iwi was trying to settle breaches of the treaty related to our lakes, which are in the central North Island, but have been on the table to subsequent iwi. So Tūwharetoa, for example, a little bit south of us, now own the space occupied by water and the space occupied by air, relating to their water bodies. The return and the establishment of lands with their own legal personhood has come about for a mountain and a river. So Te Uruwera in 2014, the mountain, and the Whanganui River in 2017, but were not options for other iwi that had gone earlier, even though they'd requested that kind of legal personhood for those landscape features. Constitutional change to protect our treaty rights has never been on the table, not from a lack of Māori asking for that. The recent establishment of a Crown Māori Relations Unit as part of our Ministry of Justice suggests a tiny change in Crown mentality away from the idea of having historical redress and kind of ending the relationship to an idea that actually fundamentally a treaty requires an ongoing relationship. So Māori have managed to have a constitutional type of relationship in some limited areas, but not on most issues. So the promises, the guarantees made either in the Treaty of Waitangi or from settlements to redress breaches get subordinated routinely to Crown or business priorities and interests. So the treaty relationship cannot yet be seen as between two equal partners. The Crown very much continues to dictate the terms and minimises avenues for Māori to engage as constitutional partners. And this is despite the principle of partnership being a key and acknowledged treaty principle alongside good faith and fiduciary duty of the Crown. What might strengthen the position of the treaty? Well, in very short, apart from genuine constitutional change, which might involve a dual house model or a written constitution, a treaty court could potentially be an easier temporary fix to assess legislation as it comes before Parliament, whether it aligns with the principles of the treaty. The Waitangi Tribunal is often called upon by Māori to fulfil this function, but is unable to enforce its recommendations to fully hold the Crown to account. So this notion of an ongoing treaty relationship brings me to my second point. Friendship is vital. So having a treaty and maintaining a treaty relationship is different from legal and contractual kinds of processes. It does require friendships. These are friendships in two regards, between the two or more parties to the treaty and amongst Indigenous peoples. One of the most painful aspects of the post-treaty settlement situation in New Zealand is the breakdown in relations amongst iwi Māori. Iwi have been pitted against one another. And this is in two ways. One, through the mandate process, where the Waitangi Tribunal has found in a number of reports that the Crown has picked favourites, has officially recognised and chosen to work with and negotiate with groups who they see are going to be more easily able to reach an agreement with. So smaller groups are often overruled. The Crown has not taken a duty of care to ensure that Māori-Māori relations are maintained. The other element of the increased tensions amongst Māori is where iwi claims to territory have overlapped, but the Crown has gone ahead anyway with all of those different groups and allowed them to include in their settlements areas of interest which overlap other iwi's areas. The result is that Māori end up fighting with other Māori because the Crown steps away from the situation once the settlement's passed, forcing Māori to try and work it out once they've been spat out the other end. So these heightened tensions are also a result of a limited number of Crown properties or land blocks that are available to be returned, because of course, like you, we only have Crown land to be returned, not private land. So friendships between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples are also vital to help continue to foster positive race relations and a political environment where it's politically feasible and desirable to respect and protect Indigenous rights. So in summary, the messy changes over time can't always be predicted. But I've mentioned a few examples here from the New Zealand context where Māori rights continue to be routinely breached because our treaty rights aren't adequately protected in our constitutional arrangements. Treaty relationships are inextricable from holding parties to account and redressing those breaches. What's on the table has changed over time and lacked consistency. Who counts as treaty partners matters. And preserving friendships in tense times is really vital. So I hope these will give you some pause to consider and try to mitigate, if possible, to achieve greater fairness for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders on the treaty journey and post-treaty. Kia ora koutou.
This was an NITV radio podcast. For more, visit sbs.com.au/NITV radio or download the SBS radio app.